And thank you also to the organizers for the invitation to speak here today. Let's see, is this a pointer here? I'll use my hands, I guess.
Is that a pointer or a pen?
That's a pen. All right, so before I get started, I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators on the work I'll present today, Jean Perez, Francois Foucard, Joe Holweg, and Alexander Chekovskoy. I'm going to start by saying a few more words about the solar wind and some background on the origin. Thanks. The origin of the, which button is it here? Am I doing it backwards?
I'm sorry.
What are you pressing? Oh, this thing. Okay.
There's a laser.
Okay. All right. Thanks. All right. Then I'll present some numerical simulations of this reflection-driven MHD turbulence. And I'll talk about the spectrum of imbalanced high cross-silicity turbulence, and then in the last few minutes talk about some extensions of this work to account for other effects. So Chris already gave us a very nice introduction to what the solar wind is. It's a very interesting topic for study because it is the theater for all of space physics, space weather, and also an excellent laboratory for plasma physics and astrophysical plasma physics. And here's a picture of the Parker Solar Probe, which Chris was describing. This is actually, the top here is the heat shield, which always points towards the sun when it's close to the sun, protecting all but one of the instruments that are behind it. Then there's one brave instrument, the Faraday cup, that sticks out and it measures the solar wind directly. Picture of its launch on August 12th. We're all very excited. And Chris already went over this, so I will continue. So one of the leading models for the origin of the solar wind is that it's driven by primarily an energy flux from Alphane waves. And the idea is goes back many years, and I'll just summarize some of the main elements of this model. So the sun launches Alphane waves, perhaps through convection, shaking foot points of magnetic field lines that extend into the solar wind. The Alphane waves transport energy outwards, the waves become turbulent, energy cascades to small scales and then dissipates, and then the plasma pressure and the wave pressure accelerate the solar wind away from the sun. Let me just talk about why turbulence is an important element of this model. Like, why couldn't we just have Alphane waves push the wind out from the sun? And there are a couple reasons. First, the Alphane waves are so weakly damped that they would basically propagate out past Earth without losing much of their energy to dissipation. You could still argue, well, you might be able to get a wave driven by the wind driven by the wave pressure force, but that doesn't work so well. Like, if you have a certain energy budget, some mechanical luminosity, think of it as an energy flux times an area, where your energy flux is an energy density times the speed at which the energy is moving. So if all your energy is carried by Alphane waves, near the sun, they move very rapidly. The Alphane speed is much larger than the flow velocity near the sun. And so if you have a fixed energy budget, you have a high V, you have a small energy density, well, the energy density is the wave pressure to within a factor of 2, and so you get very little momentum transfer and very little acceleration of the wind. On the other hand, if you can dissipate the waves and convert some of that Alphane wave energy into plasma energy, plasma thermal energy, then for the same energy budget, you have a smaller advection velocity because it's a collisionless wind. The energy is kept, the ion energy is kept by the ions. It's not exchanged collisionally with the electrons. And beyond the sonic point, thermal conduction for the ions is not important because it's supersonic at that point. But even though it's supersonic, it's still subalphanic near the sun within several solar radii of the sun. So this energy in the ions is basically moving out at the slow solar wind speed. And so you have a slower V, you can get a bigger energy density, a bigger pressure, you can push the wind much, much more rapidly. So if you can transfer your wave energy to the particles, you can get a robust solar wind. And turbulence is needed to affect that transfer for Alphane waves because the Alphane waves aren't damped linearly. So how do we understand this turbulence? Well, I'll present a model of it, starting with ideal adiabatic MHD, which needs no explanation for this audience. You can rewrite these equations in Alsasser form as follows. And actually, this is a further approximation I'll be making in this talk to this sort of transverse non-compressive approximation. I take the flow velocity separated into a background smooth background value U plus fluctuations delta V, same for the magnetic field, the background field plus magnetic fluctuations. I take the fluctuations to be transverse, perpendicular to the background magnetic field, and also the velocity to be non-compressive. Define the Alsasser variables here where the plus or minus refers to a propagation direction. the plus field is basically plus Elsasser variable basically propagates parallel to the background field, the minus variable anti-parallel. If you stick these variables and also the Alfvén velocity, total pressure, substitute these variables into the MHD equations, you can rewrite them in Elsasser form. And this is what you get if you take the plasma to be stationary and also homogeneous. So you ignore gradients in the background quantities. And there's some conspicuous blank spaces here, which I'll fill in a minute when we relax these assumptions. This equation brings out the point that Chris already mentioned, that the nonlinear terms in these equations, which give rise to turbulence, require the presence of both z plus and z minus, which means that if all of your Alfvén waves are propagating in one direction, you don't get any turbulence. You need counter-propagating Alfvén waves to give you turbulence, and that's very relevant to this model of the solar wind because the sun, by causality, can only generate outward propagating waves. It only launches outward propagating waves. We need a source of inward propagating waves to get this turbulence, which we need to transfer wave energy to the particles. So where do these inward waves come from? One idea is from wave reflection. So if we repeat this exercise, but now we take into account the background flow U, and also gradients in the background flow, density, and magnetic field, we get these additional terms here as well. And these terms linearly couple z plus and z minus. They linearly couple the outward propagating waves and the inward propagating waves. The effect of this is to partially reflect some of the outward propagating waves. It's a non-WKB effect. It becomes important when the radial wavelength of the Alfvén waves becomes comparable to the distance over which the Alfvén speed changes. And you actually achieve that condition in the solar wind because the footpoint motions on the sun have characteristic timescales of several minutes. The Alfvén speed in the corona is a few thousand kilometers a second. If you multiply that timescale by that speed, you get a parallel wavelength which can be over a solar radius. And so you actually are in this non-WKB regime. And so in principle, you can reflect these waves. There have been a number of models that have incorporated this idea and have said, yes, this is plausible, a plausible mechanism for generating a solar wind, but there are a couple of important open questions, and I've listed a couple of them here. The first is, even if you get some of this reflection of waves and you get some turbulence, is the heating enough to power the solar wind? And then the second question is, what is the spectrum of the turbulence that you get? And that question, the second one, is becoming increasingly interesting because, as Chris was telling us, the Parker Solar Probe is going to get into the region within which this turbulence is doing a lot of the acceleration of the solar wind. So let me talk about some work to address these questions. My colleague Jean Perez and I have been trying to answer these questions using a combination of numerical simulations and analytic modeling, and our simulations solve these equations. So basically, MHD with this transverse and non-compressive approximation. You can think of this as an inhomogeneous RMHD approximation. And so we solve this on a computer without approximating the nonlinear terms. Here's some details of our simulation technique. Our simulation domain is a narrow magnetic flux tube that is, you know, its walls are everywhere parallel to the background magnetic field. We ignore solar rotation, so this flux tube is just purely radial. We assume time-independent profiles for the background density, flow speed, and magnetic field strength that are chosen to resemble the fast solar wind. The inner boundary is the photosphere. So if you think about the solar atmosphere, you have the photosphere, the surface that we see when we look at the sun, which we shouldn't do for our eyes, but you know, you see the photosphere, and then above it, the chromosphere, a couple thousand kilometer thick layer, very narrow layer. Above the chromosphere, you have an abrupt transition called the transition region. And above that, you have the corona, which extends out several solar radii. All of that atmosphere is contained in the base of our domain here. We have hyperdissipation, periodic boundaries in the x and y directions. Those are perpendicular to the radial direction. We use a spectral method or pseudospectral method with FFTs in the XY plane and a Chebyshev expansion in the radial direction. It's actually a finite element code, so we break up the radial domain into a number of subdomains and do a Chebyshev expansion in each one of those, coupling the subdomains by continuity of V and B. We impose a random time-dependent photospheric velocity field at the base of the simulation with a fixed amplitude chosen to match motions, sort of speeds of granular motions on the sun. The The perpendicular correlation length of that imposed velocity field is a reasonable fraction of the perpendicular box size at the base of the simulation. So we're trying to launch large-scale waves into the simulation. We vary the time scale, the correlation time of that perpendicular of that photospheric velocity field from roughly 5 to 20 minutes. And the perpendicular box size at the base of the corona varies from 4,000 to 16,000 kilometers in the runs. I'll present three different runs in a minute. The simulations last 12 hours. They go out to 21 solar radii from the sun. It takes an Alphane wave in this field profile to about 3.5 hours to get from the sun out to the edge of the simulation. So we run a few crossing times. The first few hours, it's gradually building up to a steady state. Then we measure average quantities in the last 6 hours of this simulation. Before I present some of these results, let me say, well, here are some of the simulation parameters. There'll be three runs. Run one has the shortest velocity correlation time at the photosphere and the smallest box size, perpendicular box size at the photosphere. Run two has also a small box size, but it has a longer correlation time for the velocity field. Run three has the longer correlation time for the velocity field and a larger box size by about a factor of 4. And before I present results from this, let me say a few words about an analytic model that we've also developed to try to match these simulations. I'm not going to go into too much detail on this. I don't really want to focus on all of this, but this is more to just give a flavor for those of you who are interested in this problem of the number of different processes we have to include in an analytic model to get it to even, you know, reasonably represent the simulation results. Some of the things that we have in this model, we take the sun to launch two different populations of outward propagating waves, one longer, lower frequency, one higher frequency. So one has a longer radial correlation length than the other. We take into account a couple things. The inward propagating waves, which are Z minus waves, they're generated by the reflection of the lower frequency outward propagating population. We take into account the type of alignment that Chris was mentioning in his talk. In our case, though, it's between the Z plus and Z minus fields, which tend to be borne by in an aligned state when reflection is the source of the inward waves. We take into account alignment. We also take the waves, the Z minus waves, to be aligned only with Z plus low frequency. The Z minus waves are not aligned with the high frequency fluctuations, and so the high frequency fluctuations cascade more rapidly. Another little wrinkle is that there is a maximum in the Alphane speed in the solar wind at about 1.7 solar radii in this coronal hole that we're simulating here. And that actually leads to a reduction in the amplitude of the inward propagating waves inside of that distance, because if you think about the inward propagating waves coming from larger radius, they're being produced by reflection with one sign. But when you change the sign of dvADR, the sign of the source term flips. So after they propagate through that Alphane speed maximum, further reflection is actually decreasing their amplitude. So we build that into it, and also we take into account this idea that the inward propagating waves are anomalously coherent in a reference frame that propagates outward with the outward propagating waves because they're produced by the reflection of those waves. All of these conjectures, they are used to approximate the nonlinear terms in those governing equations, turning them from partial differential equations into ordinary differential equations that we can solve. And here's the solution. There are 5 free parameters. The same set of free parameters, those free parameters describe, for example, the strength of the sort of dimensionless Kolmogorov constant, describing the strength of the nonlinear interactions. A couple of the constants that are describing the development of this alignment. We use the same set of 5 free parameters to try to match the data from all 3 runs. And here are some of the results. So this first set of 3 panels shows for run 1, 2, and 3, the amplitudes of outward and inward propagating fluctuations is a function of heliocentric distance r minus a solar radius divided by a solar radius. The solid lines are the simulation data for the outward propagating waves. The dotted lines are the simulation data for the inward propagating wave amplitudes. This is in kilometers per second. This feature that you're seeing here is the transition region. To the left of this feature, you're in the chromosphere. To the right, you're in the corona. The dots are the model results, and the dashed lines are the model results. And you can see a couple things in this figure. One is that in the chromosphere itself, you have fairly balanced turbulence. Z plus and Z minus have similar amplitudes. And that's because about 90% of the upward propagating waves are reflected at the transition region and go back down, because you have a discontinuity in the Alfvén speed, essentially. It jumps by a factor of about 10 across the transition region, reflecting about 90% of the waves. Above the transition region, out in the corona, outward propagating waves are much more energetic than inward propagating waves in both the simulation and model, and that's because this reflection, although it's happening, it's not terribly efficient. It's only partially reflecting the waves. And you get quite large amplitudes of these waves. They build up as you go out, which sounds perhaps counterintuitive. You would think that turbulence would be decreasing that wave amplitude. That increase in the amplitude is a WKB effect, because the density is going down, conserving wave action flux boosts the delta V in the waves. We see some alignment developing between the Z plus and Z minus waves. We measure it via this formula here. The brackets are averages. And then you can see in runs 1, 2, and 3, the solid line is the simulation. In all of them, you're gradually getting more aligned as you go out, and that's also captured by our approximate model. Let me turn now to the turbulent heating rate in the three runs. Each panel contains three curves. The dotted curve in each panel is the same. Those three dotted line curves are the same, and they actually have nothing to do with the simulations. Those are kind of a reference marker. Those are from a previous study of a wave-driven solar wind, and that was the heating rate in that model. That model matched a lot of observations, and so this is kind of a placeholder for the target that we'd like to hit if we think we have enough heating to generate the solar wind. Then the dark solid line is a simulated heating rate, and the dashed line is the heating rate in the analytic model. And in all three cases, you can see, especially as you get out to a little over, say, half a solar radius, the simulated heating rate is similar to the amount that you would need to heat the solar and generate the solar wind. Which brings me to my first conclusion, which is the answer to this first question: is the heating from reflection-driven MHD turbulence enough to generate the solar wind? On the basis of these simulations, I would say yes, it is, and a promising model. Now, how about this spectrum of imbalanced reflection-driven MHD turbulence? Let's look at some of the power spectra from these simulations. So on the top left here are the power spectra in run 1 at a heliocentric distance of 20 solar radii. These are functions of k perp being the wave number in the xy plane, the plane perpendicular to the background field, and L box, that's the perpendicular size of the box, so this is like a dimensionless wave number. And you can see both for the outward propagating spectrum and the inward propagating spectrum, you have a power law scaling between dimensionless wave numbers of about 3 and 15. That's similar to minus 3 halves, somewhere in that range. For all the simulations at all radii, we fit the spectra in that same range of wave numbers to a power law, and we call that power law index alpha plus for the outward waves, alpha minus for the inward waves. And then this panel here shows you that spectral index, alpha plus and minus. Alpha plus is the thick line, alpha minus the thin line, as a function of radius, to show you how the spectrum is either flattening or steepening as a function of radius. And before I discuss those results, I'm just going to toggle to the next plot, which shows you this analogous spectral index plot for runs 2 and 3. And there are a few things in these results. The first is that if you look in the transition, below the transition region, in the chromosphere, your indices are roughly minus 3 halves. And that's despite the fact that we launch only outer scale waves at the photosphere. We're not launching a spectrum of waves. This turbulence in the chromosphere develops in the simulation, and that's a consequence of the reflection at the transition region. So you have vigorous balanced turbulence in the chromosphere. That's something that was first demonstrated by Van Bellehoyen using similar simulations that just didn't take into account the background flow like we are doing in these simulations here. Another interesting thing is that in this run 2, and we also saw this in run 1, that this spectral index goes from 3 halves down to about minus 1 as you go from the chromosphere to the low corona. And we believe that that is a consequence of high-pass filtering. So the Alfvén speed jumps at the transition region, but it's also a fairly steep function of radius in the upper chromosphere, which leads to a lot of wave reflection. However, the highest k-perp modes have higher frequencies, and so they can propagate more efficiently through that steep alphane speed gradient. So you have basically a high-pass filter in the upper chromosphere, and what comes out into the corona ends up being a very flat spectrum population of waves. Run 3, which is the one with the largest length scales, it doesn't have high enough frequency waves to actually tap into that high-pass filter. You don't get any of that filtering in that run. All right, the last thing I want to mention about these results is that in all cases at large R, they're evolving something towards like a minus 3/2 spectrum. And that's what I want to turn to in most of my remaining time. And I'm going to make an aside and talk about a model from 2007 developed by Lithwick, Goldreich, and Sridhar. This actually was one of the models of imbalanced MHD turbulence that Chris was mentioning in his talk. And let me just review this model for a minute. So first of all, my Elsasser variable z plus or minus is their w plus or minus, and they considered the case where w plus is much bigger than w minus. Lowercase lambda is perpendicular wavelength across the magnetic field. Capital lambda is the dimension of an eddy along the magnetic field. W plus lambda is the sort of velocity fluctuation associated with an eddy of perpendicular scale lambda, plus for parallel propagating, minus for anti-parallel propagating. So consider the evolution of a cross-section or slice of a z minus or w minus wave packet illustrated here. It goes down, interacts with this counterpropagating fluctuation, and comes out the other side. You can think of that interaction as a collision. The duration of that collision is roughly the parallel scale of the plus wave packet divided by the relative velocity, which is twice the Alphane speed, but just to order of magnitude, it's just the Alphane speed. That's the duration. The fractional change in that W minus slice during the collision is given by the critical balance parameter chi lambda plus. This is the shearing rate associated with this plus eddy, that's W plus over lambda, multiplied by the duration of the collision. Now they considered the case of strong turbulence, and so they just, by assumption, said let's consider turbulence for which this parameter is bigger than or greater than or comparable to 1. And then they asked, what's the cascade time scale for minus fluctuations? Well, for minus fluctuations, they cascade during they're strongly distorted, fractional change of order unity during a single collision. They're coherently sheared. Their cascade time scale is the shearing time scale, lambda over W lambda plus. So what is their parallel correlation length? It's the distance they can travel during their lifetime, which is Alphane speed times that cascade time scale. And then came their first sort of subtle argument. They said, well, the parallel correlation length of the W plus modes is the same as the W minus modes. And the reason for that is that if the plus modes are being cascaded by the minus modes, and the minus modes change from one location to another, the way in which the plus modes are going to cascade at those two locations is different. And so as the plus modes cascade and are cascaded by an agent with this parallel correlation length, the plus waves acquire the same parallel correlation length. Now, if you stick that into the expression for chi plus is just this by definition. So we have this first term multiplied by lambda plus, which is just this. They deduce that chi plus is of order unity. They assumed it was bigger than or comparable to unity, and they deduce it's of order unity. So this is critical balance. Now that focuses mostly on the W minus cascade time scale. The most interesting argument in their model had to do with the cascade time scale of the W plus modes. So consider, they got at this by considering a thought experiment. The thought experiment is, imagine you start with a full inertial range of nested W plus lambda eddies, so outer scale eddies, and then lots of eddies in the inertial range nested within them. And also assume that W minus is infinitesimal. Now, in this limit, W plus, the full vector field, is static in the W plus frame. The W plus frame moves with the W plus eddies along the background magnetic field at the Alphane speed. And the reason why they're static is that W minus is basically zero. And in that limit, W plus doesn't change in this frame. All right, continuing the thought experiment, they then introduced what I'll call the coherence assumption. The coherence assumption is that, let's imagine that we introduce these W minus eddies at the outer scale. We inject them in a way that is coherent in time in the W plus frame for time at least as long as the cascade time scale for the W plus waves at the outer scale. So imagine just basically arbitrary long correlation time for the injection of minus waves, but in this frame. All right, so we make, again, W minus infinitesimal by making W, the injection rate very small, and ask, what is the coherence time of the shearing experienced by some W plus eddy in the inertial range? So look at this little green W plus eddy here. It's being sheared by some red counterpropagating W minus eddy of comparable scale, assuming local interactions. What is the coherence time of that shearing? Well, most of us would have said, well, it's the crossing time scale divided by the Alphane speed, of course. But in fact, they said, no, it's not. In this limit, it is infinite. And the reason it's infinite is that if you input infinitesimal W minus waves into this frame in a coherent way, the Z plus waves aren't changing. So the actual vector field of W minus that appears in this location is independent of time. And that means that the shearing experienced by the plus eddy at that scale has an infinite correlation length. All right, well, let's not have infinitesimal W minus. Let's make it a little bit more interesting. Let's increase it. As we increase it, what happens to the coherence time of the shearing experienced by that eddy? Well, the simplest way to put this is that if W plus doesn't change, the shearing experienced by that eddy doesn't decorrelate. The shearing time, the correlation time of the shearing that it experienced has to decorrelate only after W plus changes. In fact, the coherence time of the shearing experienced by that green plus eddy is its own cascade time scale. In fact, you don't need to wait for the outer scale stuff to cascade, just for stuff at comparable scales to cascade, and then it will decorrelate. And in this case, what does that mean? It means that the outer scale, well, actually, the dominant W plus eddies cascade via a strong turbulence phenomenology. They cascade in the time scale lambda over W minus, so their cascade power is W plus squared divided by that time scale. Likewise, for the minus cascade power, epsilon minus is this, form the product or the quotient epsilon plus squared over epsilon minus to get rid of W minus. You get the and basically take both of these cascade powers to be independent of scale in the inertial range. You get that W plus goes like lambda to the zero. W plus goes like lambda to the 1/3. W minus, if you plug this back in, also goes like lambda to the 1/3. And that, those are the scalings that you have in for a Kolmogorov spectrum. These correspond to a minus 5/3 spectrum. Now, when I first read this paper, I thought that this was really a stretch, this coherence assumption. Like, why would the minus waves be injected in such a coherent way in a reference frame moving with the plus waves? And it didn't really make much sense to me. But after revisiting all of this reflection-driven turbulence, well, reflection-driven turbulence is a beautiful instance of this assumption holding, because the thing that's injecting the minus waves is the reflection of the outward propagating waves. They are coherent in that frame until they cascade. And so this model, although they didn't mention reflection-driven turbulence in their paper, I think it is a very workable model for the spectra that we are seeing. We might have to fold in some kind of alignment or intermittency to explain why these spectra that we see are minus 3/2 rather than minus 5/3, but the fact that they're both roughly minus 5/3 for the outward and inward propagating waves seems consistent to us with that earlier model. Okay, that's all I wanted to say about reflection-driven incompressible turbulence in my last few minutes. Let me just talk about a couple additional sort of extensions of this work. There are a couple other things you could do, a few other things that would be important to do to make this work more realistic. One is to account for compressibility, and one of the consequences of compressible fluctuations is parametric decay. Parametric decay is when an outward propagating Alphane wave decays into an outward propagating sound wave and an inward propagating Alphane wave. And then you can have the inward propagating wave, Alphane wave decay into an inward propagating sound wave plus an outward propagating Alphane wave. And you can write down the wave kinetic equations for this process in weak turbulence theory. This is something worked out in a JPP paper in 2018. And you can solve those wave kinetic equations. And you find that for the low beta case, you can develop f to the minus 1 power spectra. So 1 over k parallel, e going like k parallel to the minus 1 power spectra for solar wind turbulence which are similar, these power spectra are similar to what you see in Helios data. Helios was a spacecraft that got into 0.3 AU of the sun. And this may be going on in the solar wind, at least the fast solar wind where you have very high cross-helicity. You can also extend this to account for relativistic effects. That a simpler version of that analytic model that I presented today, just very briefly, you can actually generalize that to account for general relativistic effects, and you can solve in this model for the outward propagating wave amplitudes and the heating rate from this kind of turbulence. And it's possible that this kind of physics, which we see to be important for the solar wind, might play a role in disk winds, but more work needs to be done to check whether that's actually true. And the final thing I'll mention is another very important future direction is spherical polarization or longitudinal fluctuations. All those simulations I presented ignored fluctuations in delta V and delta B that are parallel to the background field. One consequence of accounting for them is that you can develop something called spherical polarization, something looked at by a number of people, including Vasquez and Holweg back in the 90s, where if you look at the sort of second-order effect of the transverse fluctuations, they create a longitudinal magnetic fluctuation which acts to make the total magnetic field constant to second order. And that is something that's observed in the solar wind. It's not taken into account in these simulations. And actually, it's relevant to the spikes that Chris showed in his talk, and it's something that actually needs to be accounted for a more accurate description of solar wind turbulence near the sun. And with that, I'll end with my conclusions that reflection-driven MHD turbulence does seem to be powerful enough to generate the solar wind, and it looks like at least for some parameter, some simulation parameters, you get -3/2 spectra. I will say that we have run another interesting set of simulation parameters where you get flatter spectra, like -1 perpendicular spectra, but that's a discussion for another day. Thank you.
While Andre gets his question ready.
You might have noticed that I gave the speaker an extra minute. That's because he cited JPP, the greatest journal. You only get one extra minute for all JPP citations, but you still get it.
One for all.
One for the whole thing.
Hi, Ben. So about this Littwig-Goldreher-Schiedher model, let's first consider the homogeneous case for which it was created. You can actually, the cornerstone of this model is that the anisotropies are the same, the parallel scales are the same. And you can check this directly from simulations, and you know that it's not satisfied. And the anisotropies become different, more different when you increase imbalance. So in your case, you're saying that there's something in this model that is actually satisfied in the reflection-driven turbulence, so it should work. But you can do the same thing. So you can measure anisotropy of Z plus and Z minus and directly confront this assumption that anisotropies are the same.
Yeah.
Did you do that?
We have not done that. It's an excellent idea, and it's something that needs to be done. We have done that exercise for one simulation that I didn't present here, which is an exception to this rule. It's launched in the more weakly turbulent regime, where we launch higher frequency outward propagating waves that keep their sort of parallel correlation length, which is much shorter than the parallel correlation length of the inward propagating waves. And for that simulation, you don't get this spectrum, and I don't think that the LGS model would work. For the runs that I'm presenting today, we haven't looked at the scale-to-scale anisotropy, and that's a really good thing to look at.
Thanks.
Hi, Ben.
Hi.
Great talk. So, as you know, the magnetic field of the solar photosphere is very, very intermittent. You have these thin flux tubes, very small filling factor, and they support their own modes, you know, these tube modes. And my question is whether you think they're important or if they all just damp out very low down.
I actually don't know. I think that the picture is a lot more complicated than what we do. We have a nice uniform open tube that's sort of monolithic that comes out. And there have been people who've been looking at what happens when tubes merge. And one of the consequences of, one of the models that goes into this in some detail is by Steve Cramer and Advan Balahoyan. And they look at this idea that you have these different sort of isolated flux tubes coming together and merging above a certain canopy height, and then you get a monolithic flux tube above that distance. And what, exactly is the consequence of that complex topology, I don't know, but one consequence probably is that the correlation length in the perpendicular direction of the waves that are coming up is shorter than we might believe based on, say, the macroscopic size of a granule. You might have something that's quite a bit shorter than that coming out.
So I think that your parametric decay model that you talked about, I think I understood that that's not included in your simulations.
That's right? Correct. Yeah.
So can you estimate from the amplitudes and fluxes and everything you get, though, how important those terms would be expected to be for your simulations? Like, would you expect them to dominate in any of the regimes that you see, or are they a small correction?
So in the simulations that I presented here, the radial correlation lens, I didn't actually even include this in this paper. There's going to be a companion paper with more details on the results. But the radial correlation lens of the fluctuations in these runs are pretty long. And the parametric decay becomes increasingly important as you decrease that radial correlation length. So we have another simulation where that radial correlation length is quite a bit smaller. And in that one, I think indeed the parametric decay would indeed be important. And this one, I'm not sure if it would be or not. I don't know.
I've got the mic. So between your talk and Chris's and all the changing from 5/3 to 3/2 and all the stuff, like Chris said, there's various ways you can come up with these different numbers, but one way is weak versus strong. And I guess between this talk about parametric decay, which is fundamentally just wave coupling phenomenon, and this talk about here where there's a critical balance parameter that's one, and Chris showed various things. So do we know where and when in the solar wind you go from weak to strong turbulence, or is it just you're strong from the outset? Or
another really good question. It depends a lot on what you assume are the launching conditions. So we've run simulations using this code where we get short enough radial correlation lengths that you would think that over a number of radial distances, you would have weak turbulence. But there's an interesting twist on that. Even if you make the outward propagating waves have a sort of short radial correlation length, when you look at the population of inward propagating waves, they tend to have a much longer radial correlation length. And that's because this non-WKB reflection is like a low-pass filter. It works better for the long radial wavelength modes. And so you almost always seem to generate inward waves that are sufficiently long that you're in this strong turbulence regime. Not to mention there's this other twist that they're anomalously coherent in the outward propagating wave frame because they're produced by those outward propagating waves. So you have this potential for parameter regimes in which some phenomena are strong and some are weak. For these runs here, both outward and inward propagating fluctuations are in sort of a strong turbulence regime in the LGS sense, if you take into account their arguments for the coherence time.
But how am I supposed to think about non-WKB reflection versus parametric decay?
I think this is one of the big open questions. It's not so much a theoretical uncertainty. We don't have actually a good enough description of the wave field coming out. If we knew what the parameters were of the waves launched by the sun, we could immediately draw a 2D plane and say in parameter space where are we sitting. But the problem is we don't. And so, and because of this incredibly complex magnetic topology, it's really hard to figure out what that is. So I think Solar Probe is going to tell us a lot about this by measuring the in-situ fields in at 10 solar radii.
I have a quick question then, Alex. Are you predicting this high-pass effect will operate and you'll get a hard spectrum sometimes in the data? Is that what I'm getting?
And this again, the problem, like, so to put this in perspective, the observational estimates, the two parameters we need to determine whether or not we have this high pass filtering mode is or effect and whether it's important are the perpendicular correlation length of the waves launched by the sun, the dominant outer scale of the waves at the base of the corona, and the time scale of the motions that are affecting these outward propagating waves. And if you look in the literature, there's a factor of probably 30 or more in the estimate of the dominant perpendicular correlation size. Some people say it's supergranular. Some people say it's subgranular. If you look at the correlation time, some people say less than a minute. Some people say as much as hours. So it's and the reason why there's such a big variety is that people are assuming that different parts of the scale range are making the dominant contribution to the outward wave field. And it's observationally, it's an uncertainty. And so this will be important if you go to dominant wave fluctuations being launched at comparatively small scales. And then I think, yes, it is important.
But couldn't I just say that the stuff that's launched at small scales will have the spectrum?
Yes, you could.
Whether it's dominant or not.
Yes, you could except with one exception that the things at the different scales could couple to each other, you know. But
you might have answered this question in your talk, so I apologize if I've missed the answer. This is another question that I imagine Andrei might have asked you as well. So one of the sort of robust crude characteristics by which different theories of imbalanced turbulence can be differentiated is the relationship between the ratio of amplitudes and the ratio of energy fluxes.
Yeah.
So what is that? Do you have an answer to this question? Do you know what it is? Is there some way of sort of dumping all your data on some kind of scatter plot and see what...
And doing that, well...
And let me ask a second question at the same time, which is probably, again, a more philosophical one. Is there such a thing as universal scaling of imbalanced MHD turbulence, or are all the different people whose different simulations support their different theories simulating different regimes?
Okay, so first, your first question. In this model, the LGS model, the ratio of the powers is the ratio of the amplitudes. And in our simulations, which fit our cruder large-scale model, the analytic model we published was not looking at the spectrum, it was looking at the radial profiles of bulk quantities. And in that model, for the strong turbulence regime, which these three runs are pretty solidly in, the ratio is also the ratio of the amplitudes. And actually, I haven't plotted here the minus heating rate, but we've looked at that, and it is consistent with that prediction for these three runs. We have another run where we are not in that regime, and in that run, the outward propagating waves have a shorter radial correlation length. The inward propagating waves are cascaded weakly, and so you get a different ratio of those. And so you certainly can have different parameter regimes. And I would say, as to your second question, I think absolutely the question of which parameter regime or which setup of imbalanced turbulence are you actually talking about can account for a large variety of the published models on imbalanced turbulence. Here we have this specific reflection-driven version that we're focusing on.
Well, I guess what I was thinking about in that context, right, is that it's true that what happens at the outer scale, how you launch things, you know, we all know that in order to get a nice, clean, critically balanced turbulence and so on, you kind of have to force it in critical balance, and you can really screw it up if you don't do it properly. So which means that in order to get confirmation of one's theory, one has to have the right theory first, in some sense, right? And kind of set it up that way. So I guess the general question is that, well, suppose we had an infinitely resolved simulation and went to arbitrarily small scales. Because plus and minus energies don't intermix, the ratio of energy injection rates remains all the way through into the inertial range. So are we expecting at infinitely small scales a universal imbalanced turbulence governed only by that parameter?
That might be, but you can have a very long transition to such a case. Like, so I know from an example that you can create a simulation where the outward propagating waves have a much flatter spectrum than the inward propagating waves. And so you have this broad transition which goes the entirety of our simulated domain, in which you're not universal, but it will presumably at sufficiently small scales translate to a strong, strong regime. And at that point, I would assume that yes, you could treat it locally and you'd have a universal. That's a guess, but it's a safe guess because no one will ever be able to simulate the six orders of magnitude needed to test. At least in my life. Yes.
Okay, let's have Jim, and then maybe there's another question in the back there.
Okay, so I'm going to ask a bit of a broader question, not too technical. It seems to me there's basically two issues here. One is heating of the solar wind itself once it's coming out. And you've got a lot of really good data, direct data, and it looks this modeling looks pretty convincing for that. I think heating the corona and driving the solar wind is a separate issue to some extent. And I think that's much more challenging. It's not totally clear to me that Parker Solar Probe is going to be able to get the direct evidence. But, and I think this is not going to be determined by purely a model and saying, well, how well does that describe that we get a solar wind? I think it's got to be based on what is the direct evidence that there actually is turbulence in the corona. And it, from your talk, it looks like we need to ask this question about the top of the chromosphere. Do you have that turbulence there? And that, are the direct measurements that are measuring that turbulence and therefore can convince us that that really is the driver? So can you comment about the direct evidence?
Sure. And actually, let me make two comments. One about your first statement about this not really having much to do with the corona being a separate problem from the solar wind. I actually think they are the same problem. I think one of the importances of this whole model is that you have to, like you say, you have to heat the corona to millions of Kelvin to even get the wind started. It's not just a question of explaining things at 10 solar radii and beyond, where it actually most of the work is done. And this model can sort of do it energetically, although there are some issues. It's not clear that it's everything, but it's getting to within the ballpark. There probably is other stuff going on, like compressive modes, which damp quickly in a collisionless plasma. But if you launch them, they're sure going to give you a lot of heating down close to the sun. Now, in terms of can you see the turbulence, you can see the wave amplitudes. And in fact, one of the most important studies in this regard was by Bart de Pontieu, who used observations from the Solar Optical Telescope on Hinode to constrain the transverse velocities of features in the low corona. And they can get a delta V for those features, telling us a large-scale amplitude of Alphane-like motions. Whether there's a broad spectrum of turbulence there or what its spectrum is, I'm not sure what the prospects are for looking at the inertial range. But looking at the energy content in the low corona, I think you can. And it looks consistent.
So for Hinode, there's a lot of direct observations, for example, in flares. And they definitely see non-thermal broadening from the Hinode data. Does that same Hinode data go down to the scales where you need to start all this?
Well, okay, so
even in the non-flare-related type.
Yeah, so this de Pontieu et al. Paper shows you these features. It's not, they didn't look at line widths. They were actually doing feature tracking of filamentary structures in the low corona, and they get a delta V down there. There are other instruments like SUMER, UVCS, which have line widths, which also can test these models, and people have looked at those tests. So I think the question is, we have the energy there. I think that can be established. What is the turbulent spectrum there? I'm not sure if there are prospects for observationally telling the spectrum close to the sun.
So let's thank Ben again, and thank you all for a good morning. We have a half-hour break, and we'll reconvene at 11.
Sir, I think refreshments should be in the courtyard, or I'm not sure.
Tell me. I don't know.
Yeah, and the posters are on the way to the courtyard, so just out to the left.